battles. My name is Nico. I'm a documented. La Migra never came, but the broken immigration system took my mother from my family. She died of cancer 2 years ago, and at that point I realized that I wasn't going to let my mother die in vain.
Hello, everyone. Bienvenidos to InDocuTalks, the podcast created by immigrant youth for immigrant youth, looking at immigration through a lens of news, culture, and education.
Hello?
We had a phone interview with Nico about the first Coming Out of the Shadows event for our educational segment. Let's listen to that interview.
We're about to do our national coming out action.
So with this action, it was the first Coming Out of the Shadows that happened nationwide. And a lot of the organizing that we did in Chicago just happened. It was just a lot of fighting with the people that had been organizing, that had been doing the immigrant rights work. A lot of them were politicians. A lot of them were people who were directors at nonprofits. You know, just the people that we used to see on TV talking, getting interviewed. And so they were the ones telling undocumented people to stay in the back, you know, not to say anything. Just basically spreading fear. And so I met Daniel Sueta at a party, and I was sharing my story with someone about how I was undocumented, and she just came up to me, invited me to the meetings. And then from then on, you know, it was the Immigrant Youth Justice League. You know, my mom passed undocumented and she never got to go back to her country, and I made a promise to her that I was gonna fight, and I felt like I had nothing left to lose, and if I got deported then fine. But all of the people that I was meeting, all the young people, they all felt the same way. We felt that it was time for us to speak out. And a lot of it, when the whole thing behind Coming Out of the Shadows was with the whole Harvey Milk and the LGBTQ movement and how people were coming out of the closets, basically. So we said, we need to come out of the shadows. Yeah, March 10th, that's the day that it happened. And at first I felt like I wasn't even going to be able to speak because my mom's death was so recent. But I was just so empowered during the march, like marching to downtown and leading the march and just seeing so many people there. A lot of my speech was just talking about my mom because I knew that all of the other people were going to be talking about their education and how they couldn't go to school and just the same thing that we've been hearing with the whole like dreamer rhetoric.
The first National Coming Out of the Shadows event took place in the heart of downtown Chicago, Illinois on March 10th, 2010. It was organized primarily by the Immigrant Justice League, an undocumented youth-led organization that was fighting for immigrant rights through an intersectional approach. This became a watershed moment in the history of the immigrant rights movement as it came to influence generations to come of undocumented youth who felt empowered under the slogan Undocumented, Unafraid. Previous to this action, immigrant youth were relegated to the shadows and played quote-unquote the good immigrant role of being passive, obedient, and conforming to institutional practice. Coming Out of the Shadows was the ruptured moment that changed the game. It placed undocumented youth at the forefront of messaging, actions, and discourse in the immigrant rights movement. Immigrant youth would no longer be relegated to the shadows and would go on to create the spaces of empowerment. Coming Out of the Shadows is now a common event in most college campuses, cities, and at most, political demonstrations. Nico, what do you remember from the Coming Out of the Shadows event as far as the slogan Undocumented, Unafraid and how it was born?
I remember when we did our march for Coming Out of the Shadows, it was just the giant banner that said Undocumented, Unafraid with orange letters. But the night before that whole march, the people that were going to do the speeches were in a separate room from the people that were making the art and the posters. And so a lot of it I didn't get to see till the next day. Yeah, it's definitely used everywhere. I think that it's empowered a lot of people. And I know that in my organizing work, whenever I have spoken at rallies and I say that I am undocumented and unafraid, I always get people that come up to me and say how empowered that felt for them. And a lot of the times people come out of the shadows to me after the rally. So, you know, you see what saying something so simple can just be so powerful, you know, especially when it's other undocumented people that are afraid. With the whole, like, being, I guess, like, coming out of the shadows, a lot of us that were organizing were queer. Once we started doing, like, national organizing, we began to see it even more. And so I think the conversation was always like, look, there's a whole bunch of queer people in this movement, and a lot of the people that are speaking for immigrants are these really homophobic, machista men, you know? So we were like, we're gonna come challenge them in their frame of thinking, because a lot of them were like older Chicanos organizing. And it's just like, things move forward and we need to step away from that and things evolve. But a lot of it was to challenge these homophobic, machista men that were at the forefront of the movement all these previous years. It was like coming out of the shadows. And yeah, it stemmed from that, just from a lot of us being queer. And then, yeah, the whole like undocu queer term. And from just constantly being told to stay in the back, it was just like, you know what? We're going to do this. And we actually went into a meeting with like hundreds of people that were organizing the May 1st. They're normally the people that organize the May 1st rally. And, you know, we basically took over and we went in there and we said, this is who we are. And this is what we're going to do this year. And we're tired of all of you telling us to step in the back. And we had the news there. We had like the newspapers, cameras there. So at this point, all of the community wants to see the young people at the forefront. So that's what we continue to see. And that's what a lot of us continue to do in our work, is try to empower younger people.
So we just listened to Nico talk about how folks made an intervention during the coming out of the shadows. Now we're going to listen from our education contributors, who are going to break down how UndocuQueer makes such an important part of the movement and also within our own podcast and our own collective members.
Queer is defined either as something strange or odd, or when referring to a person, denoting or relating to a sexual or gender identity that does not correspond to established ideas of sexuality and gender, specifically heterosexual norms. As a verb, it means to spoil or ruin an argument, an event, situation, etc. As an identity, UndocuQueer refers to the intersection of an undocumented status and someone who identifies outside the cis heterosexual dichotomy. The power of UndocuQueer is not only that it queers the gender and sexuality dichotomies, but that of the legal status of documented versus undocumented. By queering these two dichotomies, individuals who identify as UndocuQueer are choosing different modalities beyond the prescriptive ones. They also show that even within activist movements, individuals who quote-unquote deviate from the quote-unquote norm are pushed to the periphery. At these spaces is where we can create dynamic and intersectional critique of such movements and think beyond the mainstream narrative and how it represents everybody in that movement.
Many people don't realize that when they use the slogan undocumented and afraid or participate in a coming out of the shadows event, that they are in fact part of an intersectional practice with strong roots to queerness. This is why it's so important to push for intersectional movements. Queer activists like Nico Gonzalez, Julio Salgado, and Yosimar Reyes have been at the forefront of contesting, questioning, and creating discourse that pushes organizers to practice intersectionality in our movements. Otherwise, movements stand the potential of recreating the very same powers they aim to deconstruct. In UndocuTalks, we aim to bring intersectional critical dialogue. As such, I know that Frank and Nancy are extremely passionate about the subject matter, and they actually have quite a few things to say about what UndocuQueer means to them.
I have two mixed feelings about this movement. On one hand, being queer alone didn't mean nearly as much as it means to be UndocuQueer. This movement makes me feel like home. I say home because home is safe, because it is a place you won't be judged, a place where you are known, a place where there is love, and most importantly, a place where you don't need to be afraid. However, on the other hand, I was taught differently from my LGBTQ community. I was scared to share my identity with people who weren't like us. I knew that my parents accepted my identity as undocumented because I didn't have a choice. That didn't apply when I came out as queer. They seemed to think that my sexual identity was, in fact, a choice.
And I, too, have mixed feelings about this. Living, you know, in the middle of the Ozarks in Arkansas, you kind of are actually pushed away from both movements. Even though I can pass as a heterosexual male, being bisexual and choosing to be out forth with that identity, the LGBT community here really wasn't inviting because of my ethnic and cultural heritage. And at the same time, the undocumented community wasn't embracing because of my sexual identity. So being able to be pushed to the periphery by both of those movements, I could kind of see equally that people who hold this intersection within their own body, within their own praxis, within their own lived experience, can actually start to see the need of why there are need for spaces and for movements such as Undocumented Queer Work, an intersectional, nuanced critique and thought to the movement and purpose to the movement serves better to represent those individuals that feel left out from either one or both of those movements.
I never applied for DACA. I felt that at the point or at that moment, like, yeah, I could go get my GD. It would be whatever. But I was just, I never applied for it. A lot of the people that I know are at this, to this day, are mad at me because I never applied for it. But I also just saw beyond that. You know, I was like, Obama's only going to be in office for so long. I just didn't want to put myself in that situation. And I also felt like I didn't need it just because the type of work that I do is, a lot of it is like community organized. And, you know, I just felt like I didn't need it. And I make art. Yeah, I think for me, being undocumented and unafraid is just like something that I live every day. And that's why I continue to try to have these conversations to expand people's thinking. But also a lot of the people that I meet, even now in Oakland, like, that don't know that I'm undocumented, we'll see little snippets of something and they'll let me know. But yeah, I think that being undocumented and unafraid before DACA, also, I just think that people kind of got too comfortable. I think that it was just like, look, we got DACA. And people got comfortable. A lot of the people that were mad at me when I was getting arrested, when I was doing actions, that were afraid for me, messaging me, they were the first people in line, you know? Like, the first people that were like, what are you doing? Why are you saying that you're undocumented? Those were the first people in line. They all got DACA. So before I moved here, I never called myself an artist. It was just like an insecurity of mine, I guess. And then when I moved here, I was working with Fabiana and just being around Julio. And they were all just like, Nico, you're really talented. Like, you're an artist. And, you know, it took me like about a year. And then I was like, yeah. They're like, well, why are you here? And I was like, oh, I'm an artist. And, you know, I'm here to make art. Visual art has helped me heal. And it has helped me be able to share that with others. And yeah, it's been really powerful to be here in the Bay Area and to have gotten the opportunity to work with a lot of really badass artists who are really involved and who have really taken me under their wing, you know? And so now I think that it's time for me to, this is the year that I think I'm just gonna, I want to bring my art everywhere. You know, through art now, I just see like other possibilities opening that I didn't see before. And I feel more empowered and I feel more at ease when I don't constantly have to be dealing with people that are not on our side. And, you know, and we all have our role in the movement. And I think that my role moving to the Bay Area was to be an activist through my art.
This conversation that we've been having, we see that undocu-queer artivism stands at the forefront of these intersecting liminal spaces of being undocumented and queerness. Individuals who inhabit these spaces are at the nexus of the discursive spaces and the praxis of their lived experiences. As Nico and so many artivists point out, it is vital that they critically engage the movements that are said to represent individuals who identify as such, but oftentimes are done without taking the input and consideration from the very individuals they claim to represent. Within the larger mainstream undocumented movement, many queer folks are forgotten about, while many brothers and sisters of color are forgotten about in the gay, lesbian, and queer liberation movements, and are also pushed out to the periphery of that movement because of their ethnic and cultural background. Undocu-queer artivism, like so many do-it-yourself movements, to name one, you know, like the Riot Girls movements, don't actually run contrary to main mainstream movements, as the dichotomy would suggest, but actually parallel to those. It powers the individuals with these perspectives by giving them voices and avenues to express the narratives of their experiences in a rhetoric that does not obfuscate, but elucidates their whole being, not having to sacrifice one or several aspects of their identity to be part of the movement community. It is from this nuanced and intersectional movement that we can learn how to apply a dynamic and inclusive critique of how we represent ourselves, others, and the movement to the mainstream. As Audre Lorde wrote about feminism, and I'm paraphrasing here, but I think it applies to the immigration movement. If it ain't intersectional, what are we doing it for?
Now that we've heard our education segment, let's make a chain migration over to our new segment. We've all heard the term chain migration and the promises that the president and many Republicans to end this practice. But what is chain migration, Cindy?
So Alejandro, chain migration is the idea that if you let one person come to the U.S. or stay in the U.S., that they will then sponsor another person and another one and another until you have endless people coming over, which is actually a total misconception. But it seems easy that, you know, that they can say that anyone can come over and then you have your tía, your abuela, your prima petitioning for each other. But that is far from the truth.
That's right, Cindy. It actually reminds me of an article that I read on CNN about a man named Amer Adi, originally from Jordan, who lived in the U.S. for almost 40 years, and he was recently deported. He had a green card. He was married to a U.S. citizen, and then they both decided to move to Brazil for 3 years. Mm-hmm. His green card expired, and when he returned, he wasn't granted a new green card. According to Adi, his ex-wife had been coerced by immigration officials into signing a statement that their marriage had actually been a sham. And so to back up this claim, in 2007, she actually signed an affidavit retracting her statement. Mr. Adi was described as his congressman, as a pillar of his community, being that he was a business owner. He helped create jobs and he really helped keep and bring his community together.
Yeah, Alejandro, and you know, this is nothing new. These stories are repetitive all over the country. And I think we've all seen them. We've all had someone close to us, you know, encounter this situation. But in regards to Mr. Adi, from what we know, right, according to the article, is that Mr. Adi is currently the husband of a U.S. citizen. He has 4 daughters who are also U.S. citizens. Mr. Adi is a business owner, a taxpayer, and an integral part of this of his community, and yet he was deported.
That's right. So if the notion of chain migration was real, we wouldn't see sad cases like that of Mr. Adi and his family who are cruelly ripped apart. But this administration and this Congress doesn't really care about family unification like a lot of them say they do. In fact, according to the Department of Homeland Security and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, immigration arrests are up by 42% since Trump took office.
Right. And we know that in January 2018, for example, most immigrants sponsored by their United States citizen siblings could begin to apply for a green card if their priority date was before June 22nd, 2004. And the waiting period was of 13.5 years. Now, I mean, those from other oversubscribed countries like India, Mexico, and the Philippines would have needed to have an even earlier priority date, Alejandro. So, you know, these facts are out there. We know them, and it's nothing new to us. So the fact that Mr. Adi is being deported after living a life contributing to the economy and to his community, you know, it's just devastating. And I think we're seeing it more and more often. And it's incredibly unjust. And it's separating families. And, you know, I don't know how far from what end you're seeing it, Alejandro. But I mean, I think we are a reflection of our communities. And if we can't value the contributing members, you know, that are contributing and bringing life into those communities. I mean, who are we and what are we doing and where are our values and our morals? So what's your take on it?
The way I see it, Cindy, chain migration is all about the fear of people of color being in this country and coming into this country. Because when they refer to chain migration, they're not referring to people from Norway. They're referring mm-hmm. to people like you and me. Mm-hmm. the rest of our collective here at DocuTalk, Cindy, people who are of color, people who came to this country to make a better life for ourselves, for our families, and that had no choice in how we came here or how we were allowed to come here. I mean, if chain migration was a real thing, if it was actually that easy, I wouldn't have been undocumented for 19 mm-hmm. years because my abuela was a U.S. citizen. You know, I have a lot of family who are U.S. citizens, but unfortunately, because my mom was legal permanent resident after I turned 21, she couldn't sponsor me. Before that, when she was undocumented, she had no path because her mom was a legal permanent resident. And so, mm-hmm. you know, these are all lies. One of my tias has been waiting for over 20 years. Her sister tried to sponsor her, and she's nowhere near the front of the line. And I hear a lot of politicians saying that they want to do the right thing and that they want to do what's right for immigration. But having had the opportunity to move on immigration, the U.S. Senate did nothing last week. Neither Republicans nor Democrats caved to save the day. Instead, they squabbled about four immigration bills that they brought up to the floor, and they decided to set up a new artificial deadline of March to deal with immigration when they couldn't come to any real solutions. Because to them, that's kind of just like how they see it. It's kicking the ball down the field. It's procrastinating. It's trying to get their donors, trying to get mm-hmm. the people that they're trying to please, trying to get a deal for themselves, not for our communities. Because our communities have been on the deportation line for a long time. And any deal helps, and nobody's mm-hmm. willing to come to a compromise.
Don't believe the hype. I agree, Alejandro. And Ryan was quoted saying that immigration and DACA were an important issue, but not as important as before, given the court rulings. And of course, he's referring to now a second judge that has blocked Trump's effort to end DACA. Because as we know, according to an article by CNBC, the U.S. District Judge Nicholas Garofis in Brooklyn ruled that the Deferred Action for Early Childhood Arrivals program, or also known as DACA, cannot end in March as planned. A victory for state attorneys, attorney generals, and immigrants who sued the Republican administration. Now, the decision is similar to an earlier ruling by a federal judge in San Francisco that DACA must remain in place while litigation over Trump's decision unfolds. But, you know, again, we go back to the same idea and the same notion that, okay, now we're going to do they expect for people to just stop and be, you know, reliant on what's happening right now and that we are no longer a priority? Because if that's how people think, you know, that's not the situation. And I think it has so much to do, Alejandro, with the fact that so many people don't understand what it's like to be on the line. They don't understand what it's like to live with that fear, with that, you know, with that sense of not knowing, you know, hey, oh my gosh, am I going to continue, be able to continue my job?
That's right, Cindy. And I think we just keep doing our job. I think that for those of us that are in the front line of the immigration movement, we keep being there for those of us that are in the halls of the legislature, lobbying and advocating for law change. We keep doing it. And I think for those of us that are in the classrooms educating, mm-hmm. for those of us that are in our communities empowering, and at home sustaining our families, bringing home the bread, continuing our livelihood. You know, I think we keep doing our job. I think we continue to push for change. We continue to push to make our communities better and continue to find ways to move forward.
Hi, my name is Norma Ramirez. You're listening to DocuTalk, a podcast by immigrant youth talking about news, education, and culture. I am currently a student at Fuller Theological Seminary for a PhD in clinical psychology. So I'm interested in contributing to DocuTalk, bringing in the mental health piece for our community. I've noticed that we really don't have a lot of access to mental health care, and so I want to be able to bring what I'm learning and share it to our community so that way we can keep thriving. Immigration status is highly connected to other factors like economic stability, access to education, access to healthcare. Those things affect every part of our life, right? Like if you can't get a job, that's going to affect your health and all these other things. And so as undocumented people, we tend to face higher rates of poverty, guilt, grief, stress, isolation, anxiety, hopelessness. And sometimes even that gets translated into our bodies where we experience stress and chronic headaches. And because we don't have access to healthcare, we may suffer from some kind of injury or something that we don't get taken care of because we don't have that access. But at the same time, though, we're not a big mess. We also show a lot of strength and resilience because that's why we're here right now. That's why we can do what we're doing. And one of the ways that we have been able to do that is by maintaining strong friendships or creating relationships with adults like teachers, counselors, pastors, where we can talk openly about not just, you know, what we are worried about, but also like our status. And that helps a lot with emotional distress, and it increases the chances for us to be able to accomplish our goals, you know, whatever that may be. Our goals don't have to just be academic. They could be other goals. And so we have also been able to build an identity, right? So even as we mentioned, undocumented and afraid, that has been something that unites us, even in its different ways that we have learned to use it. And so having that identity gives us a sense of purpose as well as a civic engagement and activism that we're talking about in this episode. So therefore, we should continue to increase our well-being. And self-care is an intentional choice to engage in the activities that are required to gain or maintain an optimal level of overall health, which include physical, psychological, emotional, social, and spiritual components of an individual. And so then, as immigrants, practicing self-care may seem like something impossible because we have a lot of odds stacked against us in every area of our lives. You know, like if you're really busy working, trying to take care of your family, sometimes, you know, we view as the self-sacrifice as a good thing. And while it is a good thing that we care about our families, it's also important that, you know, we are able to be there for our families. And if we don't take care of ourselves, then we can't do that. So I can give some examples for our physical self. We can, you know, make sure simple things like drinking water, staying hydrated, making sure we get at least 7 hours of sleep every night, being active. Sometimes being active is the most difficult one because we don't really get trained in how to incorporate physical activity in our lives. So we can just start by taking a walk outside for 5 minutes, nothing big, and then just increasing it over time. And that's going to help our body, not just our bodies, but it affects, you know, all of these are intertwined. So they all affect each other. Psychologically, as immigrants with varying legal statuses, right now we're facing a lot of uncertainty and loss, right? That can produce anxiety and depression. And so, like we've mentioned before, access to mental health is difficult. But for those of us who are in school, we can take advantage of free therapy sessions that our schools offer. And so that's one way to go and take care of ourselves. Meanwhile, we can develop healthy coping strategies such as deep breathing, mindfulness, and progressive muscle relaxation. And these are really easy to like Google online. If you're interested about finding more of them, you could follow scripts and you can do it on your own, which is part of why I'm sharing them, because it's just easy to find. And then emotionally, you know, our emotions and our thoughts and our behavior, they're highly related to each other. It's actually really hard to distinguish what goes first, whether it's our thoughts and then our feelings and then our behavior, or like the other way around. And so because of that, it's really important that we acknowledge what we're feeling. So feelings on their own, they're not either good or bad, but they do give us a good indicator of what's happening with us. We can feel happy, angry, excited, overwhelmed, or any emotion. It's just telling us what we are experiencing. And so, however, though, for the what we view as negative emotions, if we don't have a way to feel them and express them in a healthy way, they can build up in a way that, like, sometimes you can just explode randomly, right? For just one little thing, right? And they can affect our relationships and our work life and our physical well-being. And because that's, you know, we're trying to be better, that's really going to impact us, how we relate to each other. And then socially, you know, part of why we have a big brain comparatively to like racial to our body, it's not because we're super smart. It's actually because we tend to be social beings. We make more social networks. And so that's actually what researchers have found as the reason to our bigger brain. And so what that means is that we need to be connected to each other. That makes us better people, and it helps us to keep grounded by being close to family and friends. And so we also need to make sure that our connections are meaningful and not only distractions, you know, because we can also have unhealthy relationships. So if we surround ourselves with individuals who will be there for us when we need them, but also just to have fun, that's going to just increase our well-being. And we also need to be able to do the same for for one another. And so sometimes it's difficult when you're, like, for example, like the only one maybe at your school, or maybe if you're not, with the racial tensions that we're feeling, it can be difficult to make new friends and new connections. But maybe finding something else that you have in common, like going to community service or joining a school organization, that could be an avenue to make those connections. And finally, spiritually, even if you don't identify as someone who practices any kind of faith or religion, it doesn't mean you have to be rooted in these faith. Spirituality is about faith and meaning of it. Right now, we might be wondering, like, what's the point? You know, sometimes it's really hard to wake up and keep going when we really don't know what's going to happen with our future. But if we can take time to explore and understand what matters to us, like what keeps us going every day, and then joining others that have a similar purpose, that's definitely going to be helpful when, you know, shit hits the fan and we're like, what is going on? All of those are interrelated, and any improvement in any one of them is going to be helpful in different areas. So the important thing is to not give up and to continue building ourselves up. Let's put into practice deep breathing. Find a quiet place where you will not be disturbed for the next 2 minutes. Get yourself into a comfortable position. Typically, sitting upright in a chair is most effective. But if you have back pain or another reason why you cannot sit upright, you can lay down. Once you find your seat and position, take a deep, slow breath and focus on the fact that you are sitting in this particular place and time. You exist. You are here. You are breathing. You may have moments where your mind wanders, but don't fret. As soon as you notice that your mind has wandered, bring yourself back to this moment. Take another deep breath and notice the way your chest rises and falls. And feel the air go in through your nose all the way down to your lungs. And slowly let your breath out through your mouth. Continue breathing in and out at your own pace. When you take your next breath, imagine a light full of love and life coming in, filling your lungs and spreading throughout all of your body, from your head to the soles of your feet and to your fingertips. As you breathe out, imagine all the stress and negative emotions leaving your body like a cloud of smoke through your mouth. Repeat this pattern 5 more times and notice the way your body relaxes each time. For the segment, treat yourself. It's a combination, you know. It's sort of like the cooler way of saying self-care. But we should also not confuse it with what it really means. So there are moments where treat yourself is going to look like, you know what, today I don't want to work. I need a break. So I'm just going to, you know, watch Netflix for a bit. And that's going to be good. But if you do that, you know, consecutively, that's not going to look good in your overall life. And so the concept of treat yourself and also self-care, there are ways so that we can sustain ourselves. And in our context, it's ways of sustaining ourselves in a society that really doesn't like us. There's a lot of different systems built so that, you know, we don't thrive. And so that's how the treat yourself and the self-care connect, because it's about doing the best for us and our community.
This has been on DocuTalks. Thank you for tuning in with your hosts, Alejandro,
Nancy,
tu amiga Cindy,
Rafael Martinez,
y Frank Berlanga Medina.
Our next podcast will air March 26th.
It's the last Monday of every month.
Follow us at DocuTalks on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.
It's February. You know what that means. Hashtag DocuPickupLines. We'll be reading some from Twitter that we saw this month. Hope you enjoy them. I can't promise you a pathway to citizenship, but I can promise you a pathway to my heart.
Like, I want to know who has the time to write these.
Twitter people. Unlike DACA, my love for you never expires.
Wow.
I'll make you forget that borders even exist. Do I need a work permit to work on a relationship with you?
These are like those things that just get
Do you like undocumented and afraid? ? Because I'm both.
Per our conversations about license, you don't need a license to drive me crazy.
Wow.
If I had papers, I would travel to the end of the world with you.
Your digits will change my life more than those other 9 digits.
Wow, Frank, I'm impressed that you can come up with these that fast.
I would cross a million checkpoints if it meant I could be with you.
Wow.
I like this one. Hasta que la mira no se pare.
That's true love, man.
Right?
You should start printing these out and putting them on those Valentine's Day. What are they called that you used to give out?
If Romney had been elected, I would have self-deported to your heart.
My love for you is also hashtag here to stay. You're so hot, you can melt ice.
Nice politics. Care for an act of civil disobedience?
Your kisses are worth crossing borders for.
Oh, this one's good. Talking about biopolitics. You, me, and a biometrics appointment. Wink.
That isn't real. I don't know what is.
You can have a direct pathway to my heart. I'm only concerned with our State of the Union. Like the DACA announcement, you're unforgettable. Every day with you is like a world without borders.
Wow.
As tradition calls, we are closing with a poem by an undocumented artist called Yosimar Reyes. The title of the poem is Queerosity.
So this is a love poem. Anybody in love? Yeah, that's good. You know, I understand that love is a social construction and whatnot. It's cute in theory, but in praxis, it's a little complicated. But this is a love poem, and I want to dedicate it to all of y'all and to all the performers tonight. I wrote it for a person that's very dear to me, that taught me that, you know, when I was growing up, you know, you are taught to believe that your queerness is something negative. I always tell people that as queer people, our introduction to our sexuality is not as, it's through puberty. It's always through an act of violence. We find out that we're queer because somebody calls us something negative. We find out we're queer because there's a disruption that happens. And I like to believe that in the future, we will live in a world and queerness is just as natural as the flowers bloom. And we won't have to exist as constantly explaining, right? So I wrote this poem for this person that taught me that my queerness was actually something spiritual and something sacred. And I'm going to leave you with that. So this one's called My Revolutionary. You tell me you don't like the city, that these buildings, this concrete numbs the senses, cages the spirit, and baby, your spirit was meant to be free. You, my love, were born to be revolutionary. Like the winds we felt sitting on top of the world free, like the tobacco you offer to blow blessings free. Like palabras sagradas que salen de tu boca y las rimas femeninas y masculinas that you buzz here on stage. You are my revolutionary, not a guerrero but a healer, because in times of conflict, mi rey, you heal. And more than body, I must agree with you that you are spirit, because more than your flesh, I'm in love con el corazón que tienes. You are the reason why I love men with noble hearts, the reason why I don't mind sharing a bed with someone. For men like you, I will ride a million barks, kill us in Oakland and find your house beneath the brightest star. Mi vida, you come from tierra, where the spirits of those who fail to cross over roam. You come from el desierto, but baby, we all know you are not deserted. You got me, and together we are four spirits, like the four directions. You have the creator behind you. You are his creation, his masterpiece, and in his journey you are traveling. You have managed to leave your footprints in my heart. I carry your blessings in my two-spirit. I carry your blessings in my hair, your teachings in my two-spirit. You are fluid, como los ríos que nuestra gente ha cruzado. You remind me that the only possessions we have in this world are our bodies and our voice, and the combination of the two must be used to honor the spirits of los antepasados. This life is a ritual, and in its sacredness, I am so glad I'm able to hug you. You are my revolutionary, and as you make your way back home into the arms of your mother, into the lips of your father, I ask that you take this poem with you. I ask that you take a memory of me with you. Plant these en la tierra que te vio nacer, en esa tierra que ha sido bautizada con la sangre sagrada de nuestra gente. And I will assure you that wherever you be, this love will sprout anew. Como el sol por las mañanas, this poem will shine on you. Now go to wherever home is, knowing that in San Jose you leave a brown boy that has nothing but love and respect for you. In the meantime, I will stay here in this shitty city, in this cage, singing and singing till the system crumbles, to the earth shakes, to borders break, and our people become awake. I will be here singing and singing into the day in which we are all free to return home.